It's Friday, baby. That can only mean one thing. It is the crack. That's right. We're back again. Fridays. What else you'd be doing, crackheads? Absolutely nothing. That's the truth. So you're here with us. I'm here with you. Very excited. I mean, we were going through what we're going to talk about today on the show. Bit of Bellemere, you know, Moses Atama. Is he popular in the United States of America? The Grizz, of course. Ben was all over that one. Dana throwing out those figures at the press conference at Dana White's Contender Series. And then, well, we got news from the Old Jewel Arena that Dylan Danis would not be making the date. And that is why he is featured on our beautiful thumbnail, Compliments of Oven, on the site here. Big, big deal. I mean, I think a lot of people were excited for this. Some will say it wasn't too shocking. And I'm shortly going to introduce a man who definitely said it wasn't so shocking. Because Mr. Ben Folks, when I floated the idea of this being the main topic, he was like, that fight ain't happening. But we'll let him have his victory lap in just a second. Before that, let's have a quick word from our good friends over at Kalshi. This episode is sponsored by Kalshi, the largest prediction market in the United States. Here's what makes Kalshi different. You're not playing against a house. Kalshi is peer-to-peer trading. You buy yes or no contracts on whether something will happen, and you're trading directly against other users. Think of it like buying or selling a stock. The line isn't set by some algorithm working against you. Public opinion sets the price. Kalshi is CFTC approved, federally regulated, which is why it's available all across the country, including California and Texas. Download the Kalshi app and use code CRAIC, that's C-R-A-I-C, to get up to $25 off when you trade $25. Kalshi, K-A-L-S-H-I. Trade what's next. Well, I did mention someone deserves a bit of a victory lap. Let's let him in here. We don't have any Chuck Mendenhall to balance this out this week because he was adamant that Dylan Danis was going to make it to the fight. Go on, Ben. See, do what you got to do, man.
Doing the old Bobby the Brain Heenan. I told you, Pizzi. You sent me a text. You're like, okay, how about we talk about this? We're coming up with other plans. And you were like, oh, yeah, the Mike Perry, Dylan Danis fight is happening this weekend. And I wrote back to you and I said, allegedly. That fight is allegedly happening, which is the best you can possibly say when Dylan Danis is on a fight card and Dylan Danis is scheduled to do anything, frankly, is allegedly he's going to do that. I'll believe it when I see it. I was proven right mere hours later. I couldn't text you fast enough when I saw that news. I was like, Pizzi might be asleep, might be in the middle of the night in Ireland. I'm texting him anyway. I don't know if I woke you up with it or something. But God, that was a great moment for me personally and a bad moment for Mike Perry.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I got the message. And, you know, Ben has an acute mind. He is sharp as a tack. And he's going to come at me. Like, I got the message and I gave him some, like, you know, fair play, Ben. You called it. Then he comes back with another one. And I was just sitting there at midnight going, I don't have the power to duel this man. I don't have the power. So I just, you know, symbolically waved a white flag in my sitting room. And Ben got the victory. But Ben, as much as it's not shocking, and I saw a report today on, oh, where did I see this? It was SB Nation, one of the SB Nation sites. And they were saying that he's actually pulled out of more fights than he's gone into now across all of the various things that he's done. But yeah, it's I believe we have a video of Mike Perry. Maybe that will underline the frustration of proceedings. I don't know if Andy has that. Here he is.
What's up, everybody? I appreciate everyone for being here and everyone who supported this card. All these professional athletes who have showed up, prepared to make weight tomorrow morning and fight on Saturday night. But let's not beat around the bush. This pussy-ass bitch, Dylan Danis, didn't show the fuck up. He's not here. He backed the fuck out because he's a pussy. So I want to give a shout-out to my new opponent, Brandon Jenkins. He's getting on an airplane right now. He's flying here to weigh in the morning like a professional and fight me on Saturday night. I no longer have to cut any more weight. So I've accepted his fight at a higher weight class. I was well prepared to, I'm still prepared to put on for the city of Orlando and spill some fucking blood in the arena. Let's go.
Wow, here we go. The Ariel Helwani's tweet says here, Dylan Danis is out of this weekend's fight against Mike Perry. Perry just announced it at the P-Fight presser, as we just saw. No communication, I'm told. Brandon Jenkins is replacing him. Would you like to be Brandon Jenkins in this situation? Mike Perry is screaming about spilling blood.
Okay,
he is.
Let's talk about Mike Perry's announcement there, because there was a range. Like, he really came out there and was like, "I'm gonna keep it professional." You could tell he was adopting a certain tone. He thanked everybody for being there. He was just like, "All right, you know, I'm gonna do a different thing than Mike Perry, the fighter here. I'm communicating with the public about what is happening at this show." And then when it came time to talk about Dylan Danis not being there, then he couldn't help himself. Then we're letting the expletives fly. We're throwing around all kinds of names and accusations. And then towards the end, where he's like, "Oh yeah, I should do something to hype up this crowd for the fight that is happening." And that's when he talks. The register goes up another level. We're talking about, we're going to spill some blood. We're going to put on for the city of Orlando, get people kind of hyped up. I got to imagine, you get that phone call. Do you want to get on a plane and come fight Mike Perry on Saturday night? And you go, "I mean, do I want to? No. No, I don't. But I'm not making any money sitting on the couch on Saturday. I can tell you that for sure. So I guess I'll go out there and I'll give it my best shot." And who knows? Maybe something great happens for you and helps elevate your profile a little bit. But no, I don't feel like I'd want to go do that. Mike Perry seems like he has found kind of a groove right now. He's also going to be mad about this whole
violent groove,
Dylan Danis situation. So, yeah, that's a tough one for him. But also, before I was about to feel bad for Mike Perry, and then you realize this is Dylan Danis. You get what you deserve at this point. If you book Dylan Danis for a fight and you are expecting him to show up and fight you at your show, that's, I can't feel too much sympathy, because as you say, this is what he's known to do. He is a pullout merchant at this point. You say he's pulled out of more fights than he's gone through with. At this point, we might be in a situation where he's been in more fights out on the street or in the crowd than he has been in a sanctioned capacity. Like, he's been in more fights with like bouncers or people just running up on him at an arena than he has been in terms of like, "Here are the fights that you were scheduled and you agreed to." That's really saying something.
It is. I agree with everything you're saying, honestly. We did have some reasons floated as to why Dylan was out of this. First, we had a video, I believe posted by Dylan, of his arm being operated on.
That's a, I don't know. Yeah.
That's a flap right there. That's
like
a skin flap.
I don't like it.
Well, there you go.
Somebody was doing that to your arm and you were like, "Let me get my camera out. You know, I want to make sure I want to document this moment." I had once where I had a staph infection from like jujitsu mats on my arm, and it got kind of bad before I went to the doctor, because I was like, "Nah, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. I'll put the cream on it." And then when I finally went in there to get it opened up and drained, and I couldn't look at it. The whole time that they drained it and everything, I just like looked away, and they were like, "Are you all right?" And I'm good. I'm good as long as I don't.
So nasty.
But then I did want to see what it looked like. So when they left the room at one point, I got my phone out, and without looking, I just took some pictures in the area, so that like later when I got home, because I was like, "I know there's a hole in my arm, but how big is it and how deep is it?" Later when I got home, I looked at the pictures and I was like, "Well, that hole is deep enough that you can't see the bottom of it." And I never want to look at it again.
My brother had the same thing on his forearm. He got a cut out, I remember. And I can remember it looked horrific beforehand. And I was like, "Oh, it looks even worse." Yeah, that they did that. Congratulations. So Dylan posted this video. But next of all these allegations pop up of clip. Well, these conspiracy theories. But not conspiracy theories. Theories of people screenshotting the same arm during his recent interview with Sean O'Malley's podcast, I believe. And there it is there. You can see it looks like a sealed wound, you might say, right?
I can't tell from that.
Honestly. Yeah, you can't.
It looks like something has happened, but I don't know. Maybe that's the stage of you ignoring that there's something going on with your arm until you have to have some kind of medical intervention. I mean, the one thing you can count on, if you did try to get away with something, the internet sleuths are going to be on your ass, Dylan Danis. They're not going to just like, no one's out here being like, "Well, let's take his word for it." They're going to go back and they're going to look. And if there is something that shows that maybe you were trying to mess with the chronology of what happened here, they're going to get to the bottom of it, man.
Yeah, it's also then Jewel Arena, the people who are promoting this event. If you remember, Dylan and Mike were on Ariel's show, and they're both complaining.
A memorable segment.
There'd been a post. Yeah, a very memorable segment. It was fantastic, to be fair. And it actually got me like, well, yeah. Dylan's in a real fight. He's in a real fight. This is going to be crazy.
That was also, though, the moment where, me personally, I was like, he ain't showing up for that.
Really? Yeah. You knew that?
Well, I mean, you always kind of suspect it, but like all that kind of stuff going back and forth. And I was just like, you sure? Are you sure you want to show up and fight Mike Perry?
Well, Jewel Arena weighed in. They've replied to a lot of people's posts about this, and the same tone being used. His own management confirmed it to be drug abuse related. And there is all kinds of images and some videos going around of Dylan Danis allegedly using some substances, we'll say. So that is kind of the undertone of all this as well. But obviously that could be a very serious situation if that is the case. But there's also a case of, regardless of all that, as we've mentioned, this is the umpteenth time. Like, we can't even count how many times this has happened with Dylan. First of all, like, where does this put him in terms of, like, he's obviously got a lot of interest behind him. When he's booked for a point, people, like, it generates a lot of intrigue online. People talk about it. We were just talking about him and Perry facing off, and lots of that to do with Perry, of course, as well. But do you think promoters would be lining up to book this guy again after this? Because seemingly the other ones didn't matter if he keeps on getting fights, right?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it works to a certain level. Like, I mentioned Bobby the Brain Heenan, the great old pro wrestling manager. One of his things he was so great at doing, I remember watching him when I was a kid, and Bobby the Brain Heenan would always be this guy who is just inflaming people with his withering criticisms and hilarious mean asides about people, and always interfering in matches. And as a kid, when I was watching it, I was like, why doesn't someone just take this guy and break him in half? Like, he is not a physically imposing man. All these pro wrestlers look like they could absolutely destroy him. Why doesn't somebody just go beat him up? And I was so hungry for that. And they knew that as a fan, I was hungry for that. And so every once in a while, somebody would get their hands on Bobby Heenan. And sometimes they get their hands on him and it looks like, oh, here it is. And he's doing this thing. He's begging off and everything. And then he gets saved at the last minute. Every once in a while, though, he'd have to take a bump. Maybe just show up next week in a neck brace, a comically large neck brace, stuff like that. And so they knew you can build this up to a point of people. They're just like, this guy is pissing people off and running from the consequences, and he keeps getting away with it, and I keep getting madder about it, and my desire to see some kind of righteous comeuppance is getting greater and greater. But you can only play that to a certain point. Every once in a while, you do have to show up and fight. And this Mike Perry thing seemed like the kind of thing where it's like, as soon as you hear that a fight like that is announced, you're like, well, Mike Perry is a buzzsaw. And you are the guy where it seems like you don't really want to do this. No one questions whether Mike Perry wants to do this or not. Mike Perry wants to do it so much, the big problem is keeping him from doing it at the times he's not supposed to do it. And so that's why this fight had a certain kind of appeal. You got to show up every once in a while, especially because these people have stuff on the line. And when you don't show up, you ruin everybody's plans. And then they're going around talking about you behind your back saying, I mean, I guess it's not really behind your back. It's in full public view saying the guy is on drugs and that's why he didn't show up. And so, like, the whole thing of Dylan Danis being this guy for the MMA community or the fight sports community where we go, this guy is a poser and he doesn't actually want to do this. And when he does get himself in a real fight, he's in over his head and he's going to get beat up. And that is a sort of appeal, like it or not, whether he set out to do that, that is the character he's created for himself and the character that people know him by. But that guy does have to show up for some fights every once in a while, or else that gimmick doesn't work. People stop giving you those opportunities. They stop being willing to risk it on you if they just don't know if you're going to show.
Yeah. It's what do you think in terms of this Jewel Arena, right? Like, in fairness, I don't think many people were like carrying that vernacular in their MMA fandom, Jewel Arena. Like, it was always just Perry v. Danis. But I think they would have probably put down a lot of money to get Perry, to get Danis in there. And they had this big press conference. They have, like, I think there's like 6 boxing bouts and a few MMA fights on the card. And then this guy, like, one of the key attractions doesn't show up. It's devastating for them, right? Like, You're not buzzing to watch Mike Perry v. Brandon Jenkins. Like, you're not going to seek that out. Like, you know, Ben, I'm basically going to read your mind here, but you know, like, you'll be happy enough with the X highlights of that.
Yeah. It's the kind of one where I'd probably forget it's happening until social media reminds me, and then maybe I'd tune in or something if it were made incredibly easy for me to do so. The problem is Duel Arena sounds like a place. That sounds like a physical location in the world more than it does like a promotional company or something. And it's a Duel Arena event taking place at like the Kia Center or something, right? So it's, that's the part that's just confusing for me linguistically. But, you know, maybe if you're trying to do something in combat sports, right, you need to find what your niche is. Like, we've seen that with so many other promotions like bare knuckle boxing, stuff where it's just like, you got to figure out where do we fit in and where do we fit in a way that we offer this kind of thing and people know us by it and they know what to expect from us. And I don't know, maybe if you're being the thing where if your guy doesn't show up, you're the person who'll go out there and tell everybody he's on drugs. Maybe that's not the worst niche that you could come up with. I don't know. But it does take a hit, because honestly, I'm ashamed to say the degree to which you could get me excited about this Mike Perry, Dylan Danis fight, especially after I saw them both going at it on Ariel's show. And I was just sort of like, man, Mike Perry is really, really about that life, man. You better know what you're doing when you get in there with Mike Perry. You know, you don't, as a rule, this is a rule I try to follow in life, Pete C. I don't want to fight a guy who seems too eager to fight. A guy where it's just like, he's like, oh, thank God, here's an opportunity to fight some. And Mike Perry has been that guy his entire life, you know? And so, like, a guy who seems like he's got nothing to lose and he is very enthusiastic about the idea of hand-to-hand combat, that's kind of a scary dude. And so, like, paired with Dylan Danis, who seemed like he had been trying to be in the combat sports world without doing much combat sports, it seemed like you kind of had a perfect mix there where it seemed like, okay, justice will be delivered. And then, you know, when you lose that and you have to do like Mike Perry against whoever he could convince to get on a plane and come fight him on a Saturday night, that's a different kind of a fight.
Yeah, it's an interesting note you make though about guys who are willing to fight, because I feel like Mike Perry's appearance adds to the game, because he looks like he would fuck you right up. And he's,
I know, imagine you know, got into a conflict in traffic, somebody cuts you off, you flip him the finger or something, and you see the brake lights in front of you, he stops, the car door opens, he gets out, and you see Mike Perry, with tattoos on his face and everything, get out of the car, come walking over, and you're just like, damn it. Let me put
a lot of people in Ireland,
real quick.
Like, you get enough points in a lad in Ireland, they all think they're the best fighter in the world. You know, like, so it's like, the eager they are, sometimes it's a psych out. You know what I mean? Like, oh, and you're like, I don't think so, actually. I don't think so. Funny story. Can't name names. So you're talking about a road rage incident. A friend of mine, driving along. Something happens. There's a situation, you know, a road situation. I think there's a few fingers being thrown up, whatever. Next of all, the guy starts tearing after my friend. Like, this guy is tearing after him in a car. My friend's like, do you know what? Fuck, like, I don't mind. Let's do this. He drives to an industrial estate where he knows there is a massive car park, and he pulls in, and the guy pulls in behind him. My friend gets out of his car. He takes out a hurl. Do you know what a hurl is?
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
A stick that an Irish sports.
Big wooden bat kind of thing.
My friend takes out a hurl. Yeah. And he's like, right, let's do this. Guy gets out of the car, pops his boot, takes out a shotgun. Friend, back in the car, burns out of that fucking... That is the craziest shit. So, I mean, Mike Perry doesn't need to go there.
That's a high card wins type situation, you know? You gotta... And see, the thing is, like, maybe if you'd have just got out and just, you know, done a Dustin Poirier, hitch up your pants and start going into the Philly shell, the guy would have just thrown hands with you. But once he saw you wanted to get, let's get whatever weapons we happen to have in the car, he's like, well, this is why I carry that shotgun around all the time. speaking of just general degeneracy, do you know what you're communicating when you're running around with this Raiders hat and the black t-shirt on? Do you know the connotations of this?
No, what is it? What is it?
Tell me. A Raiders fan?
The curls are out of control. The curls are out of control at the moment. I got this hat in Vegas, just popped it on. Tell me what I'm doing.
Well, first of all, you look like Ice Cube in the 90s with your black shirt black Raiders hat on.
Thank you.
But also,
I mean, this is all good stuff.
Here in America, the connotation is that Raiders fans are bad people and they're excited about it. Like they are enthusiastically bad people who like want to see their team commit egregious penalties, and like they take this pride in being like kind of like the dark side, like we're all gonna show up looking scary, Darth Vader outfits, stuff like
scary
that.
Right now,
you're scarier looking than okay. You usually are. But when you tell people you're a Raiders fan, especially since like now this geographic loyalty is kind of out of the picture for a lot of people, you know, they move. When I was a kid there in LA, they moved back to Oakland, then left Oakland for Las Vegas. And so now, if people who did not grow up with them are choosing to be a Raiders fan, it's kind of like you saying, like, I carry around a knife and I will stab you. That's the vibe you're communicating.
I need an edge.
Okay.
All right. I need an edge to my appearance, and I'm happy with it. I also have, like, I will say, I have a Denver Broncos hat sent to me by the great Chuck Mendenhall. I have a Minnesota Vikings hat bought at the game here in Croke Park. I have a Buffalo Bills hat bought in the presence of Ariel Helwani to appease him and to get behind.
See, none of Josh those Allen suggest that you have a felony in your background. The Raiders hat does. It does. I just want to make sure you know what you're communicating to the American fans. When I was in college in San Diego, and I worked for a while for this security company, and the Chargers games were always like the things people wanted to work security for. And then one week,
because nobody went to them, right?
Well, I mean, they weren't exactly sold out every week back then. But I remember one week where they were like, oh, yeah, no, hey, even though you don't have much seniority, you can work the Chargers game this weekend if you want to. And I was kind of like, why? Why out of nowhere? And then I realized, oh, the Raiders are in town. And so many of the Chargers season ticket holders know the Raiders fans are awful. They will make it feel like a Raiders home game when they come here. And so they sold their season tickets for that one on the internet to like Raiders fans. And they knew, man, it's going to be rowdy. And all the people who had a lot of experience working the security at the games were like, I'm calling in sick for this one. And I, the Ooh. Spidey senses were tingling. And I was like, you know what? No, I'm not going to work this one.
Oh, I wanted you to have a story about working that event.
The story is I didn't work it and a dude got stabbed and I watched it on the news that night. They had footage, like somebody had a camera in the car. You could see this guy stabbing somebody like under his armpit. And I was like, you know what?
Holy fuck.
And I was at home safe. I'm glad I made the right choice here.
Are they the biggest hooligans in NFL, would you say? Like, you know the way they have hooligans in like soccer and stuff? Like, would you say they have the rep for
that? Yeah, I would say. Like, just like historically, they have the rep. I mean, other teams have a rep for like really showing up for their team. The Buffalo Bills, the Bills Mafia has a rep for partying hard. In the parking lot before the game. And I respect the hell out of everything they're doing over there. But the Raiders fans have the reputation of like, we are the ones who will resort to physical violence before, during, and after the game.
Black hole, baby. The black hole. That's death.
Yeah.
That's
what it's that nothing is. Good. It's not a nice place when you call it the black hole.
Speaking of the black hole, a lot of noise on good old X over there, which is quite like a black hole in itself in a way. A lot of noise, not only about Dylan Danis and what he may or may not have been doing and the shape that his arm may or may not be in. Bellemere, they are coming out to destroy this 23-year-old girl after Dana White's Contender Series. Ben, you wrote a lot about this. And, you know, I feel, and I know you highlighted this in one of the pieces, it's kind of weird to see so many people celebrating the demise of essentially like a young girl with not a lot of experience in MMA, put into a massive situation, of course. Like, it was a highly hyped Dana White's Contender Series. I know Uncrowned, like, were on special protocols compared to the other kind of Dana White's Contender Series coverage because it was that big. All that to say, is this not a bit extreme, guys?
Yeah.
Can you just calm it the f-
Well, also, I know people love the term fraud checked. Whoever taught the internet and the MMA internet in particular the term fraud checked, they're kind of in a Oppenheimer situation. They have unloosed a terror on this world, and I hope that they feel some guilt over it, because people just want to throw it around all the time. It's not like she went out there and she looked terrible or anything. Like, she was a 4-0 fighter, 23 years old, very early in her career still. This was a big moment. She went out there and it seemed like to me, my read on the fight was she'd been rolling over people. She came in as a minus 6,000 favorite. You know that the UFC is sort of behind you. Dana White is not even pretending that he is not all the way in favor of you. He's like,
he said he met 3 years ago to plan out a career. Yeah. He said that on the show.
He's like, I'm not at all unbiased about her. You know, I'm very pro Bellemere. And so, you know, you have all that going for you, and you probably, whether you want to let that get in your head or not, you probably had it in your head. They gave me somebody I could destroy. I'm in a position where everybody's going to watch me destroy her. And then the next step is the UFC. And it seemed like she went out there, she started fast. And then when she looked across and saw your opponent's still there, she doesn't even look bothered. She, even when you hit her with a good shot, she's just still right there. And she never looks like she is intimidated or taking a backward step. Credit to her for that. But it seemed like Bellemere was not able to transition to what's the next step after that when this person ended up still being here and still giving me a tough fight. And that's just inexperience, probably. You know, that's why you have these sort of development fights. It's not a disaster to go out there and lose a narrow decision, a 29-28 decision in a close fight in a situation like that. It's only a disaster if you hyped her up to the point where, because of the name, because of the betting odds, because the UFC clearly wanted her to win that fight, that then it seems like a disappointing result. 4-1 is not a bad record for somebody early in their career. Like, these are the kind of fights that you learn more from than when you go out there and if you beat somebody in 30 seconds, you know, like, this is a fight that you'll probably be able to take something from. And it is, though, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because you come in here, you've got the last name Mir. Everybody in MMA knows what that means. They know you're Frank Mir's daughter. They've been hearing about you for years. They've been expecting you to show up on the scene. They're dying for something interesting to happen in some of these women's divisions. And so when you show up, people kind of go, all right, here we go. You never get a chance to be a product in development. Everybody is watching and they're trying to draw a lot of conclusions every single time they see a fight. That's just the flip side of it that comes with they also already care, which is not the case for most 4-1 fighters. Like, you have their attention, but also they're going to be jerks about it if you fail to meet expectations.
Yeah, that's very well put. I also think that in a way she's like a victim of the modern era of UFC, because Contender Series like has changed. And I talked about this a bit on Wednesday's show. Contender Series has changed like the criteria of what it is to get to the UFC, because on the regional scenes, all the best fighters used to fight each other. Say, like, it's a regional scene being Europe, say. Like, a Cage Warriors, which was a dominant brand in Europe, or a KSW, which was the dominant brand in Europe. Not that KSW was a feeder for the UFC, but certainly Cage Warriors. The best fighters fought each other until one of them had the belt. And then they're the best fighter in Europe. Everyone kind of unanimously agrees that they go to the UFC and they fight in the UFC. What's happened now is, because of the Contender Series, a conveyor belt of talent is now needed. And what do Contender Series want in talent? They want undefeated records. And so they have all these people going in there with these shiny, beautiful records that have never really faced a lot of adversity in the cage. Like, I've met, and I'd like your take on this, Ben. I've met so many coaches over the years, and granted that the game has changed, but a common refrain I've heard from coaches is, a fighter, like, it's nearly better if they lose before they get to the UFC. You do not want that loss, the first loss of your life, when the lights are shining the brightest. And I feel like that's exactly what's happened here. Mir, to me, is a sense, like, she's a fantastic athlete. She has an incredible pedigree. She has a great coach and mentor in Frank Mir, who's a brilliant heavyweight champion. But what it looked like to me in there is that this person's never had it put on them like this. There's a panic in the corner nearly where she's like, oh my God. This was all set up as you laid it out there, Ben. Like, this was meant to be a home run. Frank Mir's daughter looks great getting off the bus too. All of these, fantastic grappling achievements. She's going to run right through her. She's back in her corner having a panic attack probably. Like, what in the fuck is just... Even if she won that first round, she is sitting down going, this is not what I expected. I am not getting this girl to the places I want to get her to. And then it kind of falls away. And it was a very close fight. But do you agree with that? Like, this idea that they all need to be these perfect, shiny prospects going on to Contender Series without the battle test that used to happen on the regional scene, because there just wasn't that many opportunities to go to the UFC. it was a lot rarer, and you didn't have to feed this new Contender Series system. So I think that's a bit of the subtext there. Like, are these guys actually getting real tests before they get to Contender Series?
Yeah, that is a fair point, especially because one thing I've heard a lot of fighters say over the years is that you don't want to be trying to learn on the job in the UFC. You need to be pretty close to a polished product by the time you get in, because you're not going to get that many opportunities to make an impression once you're in the UFC. You're going to face tough fights, for one thing. People are going to be drawing their conclusions about you pretty quickly when they see you. If you show up and you go 1-2 in your first three fights, people are going, oh, this person's not going to turn into anything. And they'll kind of give up on you when you might still be a significant work in progress. And so you want to do all that stuff lower down. But also, there are fewer opportunities to do that now. I think that the Contender Series, especially, they highlight the contender aspect of it. And how many times do you see Dana White show up and be like, I'm not looking for 33-year-old fighters on the Contender Series? Keeps booking them sometimes. They're there apparently to be opponents. That's what you're kind of telling people, is that, like, we brought in one guy to win, look good, sign this development contract with the UFC. We brought in the other guy to be the punching bag for that, or to be, you know, something of a test for that. But it is like a weird thing that has sort of disrupted a little bit of the normal ecosystem. And it's not just the Contender Series that did it. I think COVID did a number on a lot of, like, regional promoters, just because they didn't have TV deals. They didn't have huge sponsorships that they could count on if you're not running shows. You know, you're selling tickets, you're selling sponsor tables. That's how you're making a living. And if you had to shut down for a while, a lot of them just decided, you know what, this is where I get out of the business. And I did a story maybe a couple years ago on the Contender Series. It might have even been before Uncrowned started. It might have been back when it was when I was just writing for Yahoo. And I looked at a lot of different aspects of the Contender Series and talked to, you know, smaller promoters. And they were saying, one thing about the Contender Series is that if we have a guy who comes up, fights a few times for us, and then he goes to the Contender Series and he loses, we don't always necessarily want that guy back. Like, if he doesn't get the UFC contract, it's kind of a tough job sell for us to take him back, because one of the things we're trying to sell people on when we're selling tickets to these events is, hey, come see these guys. They might be future UFC champions. These might be guys you're watching in the UFC someday, and then you could tell everybody, hey, I saw him when he was fighting at this casino in Wisconsin or whatever. And if you go to the Contender Series, everybody sees you lose, everybody sees you not get a contract, and then you come back to us, but you're still good enough to beat these other people we have, it tells everybody too much. These other people we have are not good enough for the UFC either, because it's been proven that you're not good enough. And so it kind of disrupts a little bit of the flow of what was happening there. And yet for the UFC, it works as such an efficient conveyor belt to get young talent in there, to sign them before they have a chance to go be a free agent somewhere else, maybe build up their asking price. You sign them to pretty cheap contracts for the UFC. You treat them kind of as penny stocks. You just sign a whole bunch of them, bring a whole bunch of them in, and all you need is one or two of them to hit.
That's a great analogy.
And it's a big deal for you. And when you look at some of these fight cards, like you look at the fight card that we had last week, it's a bunch of Contender Series products on these fight cards. And so it works really for the UFC, but it does also have like a downstream effect in MMA, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. One of the people who was maybe most engaged on social media in the aftermath was Bellamy's mother. She came out and she gave a lot of people what's for. And I can sympathize with that. I'm not a parent like you, Ben, but I can imagine you're in that situation and you see people having a field day that they were absolutely having online in the aftermath of this, and your young daughter is in this state of disarray, losing this massive opportunity with the light shining so brightly, as we mentioned previously. She got on there and she gave him a piece of her mind, you know? She let him know that she didn't quite agree with what the judges had to say. Kind of went, maybe a little bit too far, but she has issued an apology. And I'm saying this all to bring you around to the to you exploring this in the mailbag this week. Have you seen the apology?
Yes.
Would you like me to read it?
Yeah, go ahead. Read the apology, I saw it.
It's very long, but let's get into it. I want to address the comments I made after the fight, but first I want to give you all a very deserved explanation. After the fight, I went on to Bella's comments and I saw comments telling my daughter to die and to kill herself. I reacted as purely an emotional and protective mother after seeing my daughter go through such a hard loss and let the alcohol and adrenaline get the better of me. I've been there. However, that is zero excuse. I want to sincerely apologize to Alex Abadaka, her team, the judges, and the fans. Alex fought a brilliant fight and earned the win fair and square and deserves nothing but respect. My out-of-line comments were entirely my own and do not reflect Bella and her team or the values she trains by. I'm stepping back from social media to let Bella focus on her recovery, and I ask everyone to direct their frustration towards me and not my daughter. So please, in that vein, Ben, go ahead.
Okay, first of all, I would not tell people that if they didn't already know, I wouldn't have told them about the alcohol.
Because, it was pretty obvious, you know? If you've ever had a couple of beers, you know what was happening there. You know what I mean?
I think it's understandable to a degree that, for one thing, when it's your child, you are more likely to have a unrealistic sense of their ability and success. I know that from, I've gone to and watched my daughter do ballet, and I'm just like, well, that's obviously the most perfect angel that anybody has ever seen, right? Like, should we call the Paris Opera Ballet right now and tell them just to keep her spot warm? And then, my wife, who has been a professional dancer,
yeah,
and is a professor of dance, was like, yeah, she did good. She did good, and I was like, okay, bring me back down to earth. But especially, like, imagine how heightened it is. You've watched her come through, and this a very dangerous and difficult job, a dangerous, difficult job that you've seen how bad it can get. You've seen the ups and the downs by watching your husband go through it. And then you watch your child go through it. And the, like you said, the way people took a certain, like, joy and delight, some of that being like, okay, the UFC has clearly christened this person as their chosen one. And so when that person loses, there's a little bit of like, ah, ha, ha, you can't script this. And that's one of the things that we like about this sport. But I can see how those sort of reactions, and the internet is going to be extreme. It's going to be like, there's just, the internet is churning out assholes at an unprecedented rate. So of course, if you're paying attention to that, if you're paying attention to all those negative comments and they're directed at your child, especially in this moment of disappointment, you're going to get really, really upset about it. And you're going to take it really personal. It'd be a lot easier probably to shrug off those comments if they were about you than if they are about your child. And so I can understand getting fired up about that, flying off the handle a little bit. You got to keep it off social media, though, and you got to not just keep feeding that hate.
Feeding the beast.
Because especially at that point, while I understand where that can come from, you're embarrassing her. She doesn't need that. You know, she let her speak for herself, let her like stand on her own two feet, be a professional. And when she came out and made a comment about it, I was like, that's how you handle this. You know, she seemed like she had a good perspective on it. Bella,
she actually did. She was incredible.
Yeah. And you're like, that's what you should do. Like, you want to see that she's going to take her lumps. She's going to learn what she can from the loss, and she's going to come back better the next time for it. And everything that about what she said seemed like that. And then you just sort of take the attention away from her by going off on social media and detracting from that. Now that's what people remember from the fight. Like, I can kind of understand the impulse, but you got to resist that, because otherwise, like, you're really embarrassing her, and you're putting a darker cloud over this thing that people are going to remember.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. Interesting. You seem to have a different approach to parenting than my own father. Wouldn't be the biggest Peter Carroll in sports fan out there, gotta say. But with all this said, right, and Bella Mir, like Dana White was talking about, a unicorn. You know, she is, and obviously she has, she is stellar pedigree in terms of grappling. She's won a lot of events. People were very hyped on her. I think the next step is so important, Ben.
Yeah.
Because this is a lot of fight game to receive this early. You know, she has looked into the belly of the beast there. She has been in the belly of the beast. It swallowed her up, essentially. And now I feel like her next move is going to be so scrutinized. Like, if I'm handling Bella Mir right now, I'm just taking her out of the whole UFC universe for this next fight. Like, I don't want her on one of the feeder leagues that can go through the socials on UFC Fight Pass and therefore on the UFC. I want to keep the deal with Dana and the lads intact, but just say, listen, we need to take her over here for a minute, build back some confidence, get a few reps, and then maybe come back to Contender Series next year, maybe. What would your feeling be on that? And do you think the UFC would be open to that based on Dana's comments highlighting how invested he was in her career already?
I would think that she'll probably fight, her next fight would probably also be in the Contender Series. Right, like I would not be surprised
this season.
I don't know about this season. I mean, depending on what your timeline is for recovery and coming back, but it's hard to take those backward steps. It's not like baseball where you can send you down to AAA and let you get a few hits and get your confidence back up, and then we bring you back. Like every fight is so meaningful, and so if you send her back to a regional scene somewhere and she loses or just doesn't look great, then it's really a disaster. I think the UFC is kind of going to go all in and see how far that they can ride this. But I also think that just a loss like that at this point in the career might be a good thing at times. You know, like maybe sometimes you need that. You need that little check to go back to the gym and be like, okay, I still got some work to do. Maybe the work is just rounding out the game, or maybe the work is on the mental side of it, like going out there and not thinking it's going to be an easy night of work every single time. But there's plenty of examples of people who had absolutely amazing careers that had early losses in their career. We've seen it over and over and over. I mean, Chris Cyborg lost, what, like two fights? One of them was the first fight. The very first fight you ever had, lost and came back. Like there's a lot of those kinds of examples. And so I don't think that this is something where they need to go into panic mode and be like, all right, let us go find the easiest tomato can that we can get. You know, don't go out here and do one of these things where you've all seen it on social media, where in one corner it's like a polished, excited fighter, and on the other corner it's like a soccer mom who looks like she wandered in here by mistake. Yeah. Let's not do one of those, because everybody's going to know
that was Alima Leigh McFarlane.
Yeah.
That was former Bellator champion Alima Leigh McFarlane, who, like, there was a genuine soccer mom there.
Yeah.
You know,
Kim Couture also had one of those early in her career. You know, the wife of one of the wives of Randy Couture. She had one of those where she was trying to come up and have a career. And she had one where it was like, okay, did we find this person at the concession stand and be like, what? These gloves look like they'll fit you. Get in there. You know, don't do one of those.
Get out there and be somebody.
Like, give her another real fight. Like, give her maybe another, like, Contender Series fight and see what she has learned from it. Because I think there were a lot of positives you could take away for a 23-year-old fighter at that point in her career. Like you said, like, there's a lot of, like, physical gifts and physical tools that she seems to have. I think she could still turn out to be a really good fighter.
Is Frank's role in the camp a good thing, a positive, given everything that he's been through? You wrote about in your column, you talked about Robert Follis talking about the Misha Tate and Caraway situation back in the day. That didn't go quite well. It's common enough with female fighters to have a coach that they're involved with, but obviously a different situation, father and daughter here. Is that to be determined? How do you feel about it on the outlook on that?
Based on what I've seen over the years in fight sports, I'm against the coach being somebody who is like an important person in your personal life, in addition to being your coach, like a parent or a, you know, a relative or a romantic partner. I just think that that's tough to do. It's very common, but I think that it's really tough. And that was the thing that Robert Follis was trying to tell Brian Caraway and Misha Tate. He was just like, you can't be her coach in the gym and then go home and be her boyfriend. What she needs at home is a boyfriend. And you're still going to be kind of wearing the coach hat. She's sitting down to eat dinner and you're just like, I don't know if I'd eat that. You know, and
you mean that potato?
Yeah, like we got to cut weight. You know, is that the best? And she needs a different kind of thing there. And it's very tough to be changing those hats in time and making sure that you're being the person that she needs at that moment. It's way easier for her to show up and the coach is the coach. He lives at the gym. That's when you see the coach. Yeah. He's going to be responsible for you then. He's going to tell you what to do then. And then when you go home, you can get the support of the boyfriend who is not also the coach. And so I think that that's tough. We've seen a lot of fighters, we've seen it in boxing a lot, where a lot of people be coached by their dads. And that can go for years and years and years. And the two most common things that happen as a result of that are the growth stops eventually, or
yeah,
it becomes such a contentious relationship that then you destroy that personal relationship by trying to pursue this coach-fighter relationship. Like, you talk about, I don't know if you ever watched that HBO thing they did on Roy Jones Jr., I think when he was going to fight Joe Calzaghe, and it was years ago. It was like 2008, probably. And
I watched the fight. I didn't see the we didn't get them over here.
Oh, it was great. It was back when they used to do really, really great ones. And they go with...
What were they called? HBO?
It was like 24/7 or something like that.
24/7, yes, yes.
They go with Roy Jones Jr. where he goes back to like visit his dad and talk. And you can see that he and his dad are trying to find anything but boxing to talk about. His dad knows the fight's coming up, but you can tell they've had such a rocky relationship over the years that they've had to get to a point where in order to maintain any sort of father-son relationship, they've had to decide this topic is off limits for us. They're just like, they're talking about livestock. They're talking about hunting. They're talking about anything else. And when they leave, the producers, you know, they got the camera on Roy as they're driving away in the car. And they're like, you know, you guys didn't talk boxing. Like, do you think he just didn't want to talk? And Roy Jones says, he'd rather talk boxing than anything in the world. But we know we can't do it. Like, and so like I think it's very tough to mix those things and have it go well for a long, long period of time. I just think, like, I don't know. I was coached by my dad exactly once in youth sports because my dad loves sports and I always had lots of thoughts about it, you know, when I would come home for practice or he'd watch me in a game. When I played high school football, my dad would wait up at night until I got home from the game so he could talk about every single play that went on.
I've been there.
And when I played baseball, I remember playing baseball, you know, in like the youth leagues when I was like 13, 14. And I had said something to my dad, like, you don't ever want to coach these little league teams or anything? And he was like, you don't want me to coach. And then we got to the point where, you know, there's just not enough parents volunteering to do it. And so when he was like the assistant coach or something, and I found out he was right. You know, he knew what he was talking about. I remember like turning a double play or something and I got out, I was jogging off the field and he was like, that's not how you're supposed to do that. You should have done this instead. And I was like, I turned a double play. It worked. But, you know, on your own kid, you're going to be hard. You're going to be very, very critical. It's going to, like, the pressure of it feels like you're always carrying it around. We get in the car to go home. We're still carrying it around. And especially if you're doing it for a living, you're both adults. You're doing it at this extremely high level. There's so little margin for error. That's a heavy weight to carry around with you for years and years.
Yeah. And look, of course, there's been famous successes. Abdul-Namak with Habib and... But to your point, like, I can remember I was talking to Andy Aspinall and he has so many dilemmas that he's openly talks about with Tom. You know what I mean? He's like, before they were sparring before the Pavlovich fight and I was interviewing Andy and he was like, just an aside, I didn't even ask him about it. He was like, do you know how fucking crazy it is, like, getting guys to come to the gym to try and fuck your son up?
Yeah.
Do you know how crazy that is? You're like, I hope this guy's good so he can try and fuck him up good and proper so he'll be ready for this fight. And he's like, he's having this mental battle in his head, like, what am I actually doing here? You know what I mean? It's insane.
But then the flip side of that, as I mentioned in my column, you know, I remember talking to Antonio and AJ McKee about it. Because I knew Antonio from way back in the IFL days. And he was somebody where he was always very realistic and practical, that he knew this world, the fight sports world, it is exploitative by its very nature. It's cruel. It is unforgiving, and it's just going to try to extract as much as it can out of you while giving as little as it has to back. And he was always like very clear-eyed about that. And so I was surprised when his son went into it and proved very early on to be a great talent. And I remember asking him about it, and he was like, well, I really tried to keep him out of it because I was trying to steer him. I was like, how about a career in law enforcement or something where there's benefits, something where there's a pension and there's some job security. Because he said, I've been self-employed my whole life. And there's times where you don't know where the money's going to come from. You don't know how you're going to get yourself health insurance, all that stuff. And I didn't want to see him go down that route. And then I realized, you know, he was fighting kids at school. Kids were betting on it. They were taking cell phone video in the bathroom. Like, they were setting up their own kind of fights. And he was like, well, he's going to do it. It's in him to do it. And maybe I shouldn't be surprised. He grew up in the gym. He's got my DNA in him. He's been around it his entire life and he's excited about it. And so the next best thing I can do is make sure that he's really well prepared. Again, he only seemed to relent on it when he realized I can't keep him out of it. I also kind of realized, like, when I was his age and wanted to fight, who was going to tell me no and I would have listened? So might as well see that he gets good training.
Yeah. No, all good points. Moving on. another one of the Nurmagomedov tree we've just learned. Usman Nurmagomedov, we talked about him at length next week, claims he's already been offered $2 million, over $2 million, I believe it is, by PFL. Obviously, they're in the exclusive matching period at the moment, as far as I know, as far as John Martin has said. Usman's quote, and I'm quoting Championship Rounds here, negotiations with PFL is still going, 90 days have to pass, after that we'll see, but I have previously turned down $2 million. When we made our request for a new contract, the numbers were different, higher than $2 million, it says there. Sorry, that's from our own article over there on Uncrowned, I should have quoted. But, right, you know, how much money do you think Usman is preparing? Not to say that he's made the wrong decision here. Like, he is in a situation where he's got to hear all the offers, all right? He's going to get out of this exclusive period. He's going to hear all the offers. You know, you don't look a gift horse in the mouth. This is $2 million.
$2 million for what, though? Like $2 million per fight? Is that what he's saying?
Per fight is what he's saying. Yeah.
That'd be tough to turn down.
You know what I mean? Who is earning that? Who is it? I would say, honest to God, who is earning over, right, obviously, let's take McGregor and the superlatives, Rousey's all them out of the situation. I would say right now, people who are earning over $2 million is like Ilya, Pereira, Aspinall maybe, you know? Like, obviously, Jones not in the situation, those kind of people. Like, this is like, this is top, top money, I would assume, in MMA.
Yeah, you know? I mean, if it's $2 million per fight and any fight, whether it's a title fight, whether who, no matter who it's against, if it's just like, hey, you will never make less than $2 million per fight, that'd be hard to walk away from. I understand, though, if you're saying not that, hey, $2 million, you're not even in the ballpark of what it's going to take to keep me, but if instead you were saying, it would be foolish of me not to hear other offers. I get that.
Okay.
Especially, but like, you also are operating under the assumption that once you do hear the other offers, they're going to know what's up. If you hear the other offers, you call them back later that same day after the negotiating period has ended and be like, okay, I'll take your deal. You know, they're going to know, like, all right, you know, that's, he was not getting anywhere close to that. I do think for those guys, the quality of competition, legacy, things like that, those are probably very valuable things that mean something to them. I don't want to say they mean more than the money, but those are going to be factors for them. I think that they're thinking, hey, if you want to make a point and prove that you're the best in the world, if we want to have, they're sitting around over there going, we want to have another UFC champion in our stable. We're not that impressed by having another PFL champion in our stable. And, you know, we're already doing pretty good money-wise. So, like, I'm sure that that factors in. You just wonder how much. Because $2
million,
is the UFC going to offer you more than $2 million to come in and fight any fight, whether it's a title fight or not? Like, if the UFC did do that, I would tell them it was a bad idea. Because the machine the UFC has built doesn't really need him. I mean, I don't want to say that negatively. It would be great to have him, especially if we're going to be talking this, we have the best fight and the best stuff. It would be really good to have him. But from just a business perspective, are you going to be making that money back if you're paying him $3 million per fight to do absolutely any fight? I don't know if you will. And you also might just be sitting over there, if you're the UFC, going, hey, even if we don't get this guy as a free agent, if we can just make them way overpay for him, as and like hurt them as a competitor that way,
that's also a
win for us.
That's a great point. Does it make you feel any more confident of PFL's chances if the information is correct, right? If Usman is not talking out of his arse here, like if they are actually offering $2 million a fight, does that make you feel like they have a better chance
of keeping him?
Yeah.
That's tough to turn down, you know? It's just knowing what we know.
Man, I will say, like, you know, there's graduates of Contender Series that have made nearly $11 million. And
okay,
we don't know who that is. But, you know, that's what I'd be saying to Usman. If I'm the UFC, you don't even have to go to Contender Series, Usman. Do you hear what I'm saying to you? You don't even have to go through the blender. We're letting you come right in. And maybe if you have 30 fights.
Yeah.
11 million.
If you have 30
short
fights.
Six of them are short notice.
A bunch of them on short notice. A bunch of performance bonuses. 30 fights. That's 30 fights is a career and a half for most people in MMA. So like, that's crazy. If like, that's what your expectation is of like, trying to map out your future. You don't 30 fights is a lot of wear and tear on your body to go through. I mean, $11 million over the course of that, I guess, is pretty good, but it's also a lot of work to get that. You know, if you were an NFL slot receiver, you could get there without having to do the equivalent of 30 fights in the UFC. So I'm sure, especially for somebody like Nurmagomedov, where you're sitting over there and you're going, I think I'm going to be a champion either place I go. I am a top tier fighter. I think I'm one of the best in the world. And so I could see the UFC enticing you over by being like, hey, maybe we're not saying $2 million per fight, but we're saying we think you'll become a champion. You also think you're going to become a champion, right? And so if you become a champion and win 5 straight championship fights, here's what the money will look like. It'll be way greater than $2 million. And not taking into account how many UFC champions win 5 straight UFC title fights, it's extremely hard to do. You're also going to face different competition if you stay in the PFL. I mean, one thing, maybe it's encouraging for the PFL that they think they have that money to spend to keep a fight on Nurmagomedov.
The Dubai deal must be re-upped already because, my God. What do you think of Dana's kind of declarations at these press conferences? The other one was graduates of the Contender Series since 2017, which make up most of every card now, have earned $225.3 million. Very exact figure. I was talking about an Ariel show during the week, and I was like, this is like saying fighters from Ireland in the last 10 years have earned over $300 million in the UFC. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like...
one guy in particular.
Yeah, someone's doing the heavy lifting here, you know, is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, the thing to me is, I'm curious why he decided to start doing this. Because it wasn't something that it felt like he was under such tremendous pressure, like he's showing up every week and people are going, tell us how well, we think the Contender Series people are being underpaid. You know, I mean, we know they're all getting like pretty poor entry level contracts and everything, but it's not like you're under a new kind of pressure where he felt like, I got to go on the offensive on this and come armed with some numbers. Like, that seemed a little bit strange to just decide, like, kind of like proactively that we want to do that. But also, to me, every single time he does this kind of stuff, I'm like, do you want to tell us what they're paid or not? Because you want to kind of cherry pick and collect the numbers in such a way that it makes it sound good for you, where you say, collectively, they have done this, or there's one guy who you're not going to name who has done this. And I'm just like, why do that if you're not just going to tell us? Show us all the numbers. Mm-hmm. We've seen the UFC do this every once in a while, because they'll tell you, on one hand, it's a state secret what everybody's paid. Can't possibly let you know what people are paid. And then we've seen instances in the past where somebody complained about their pay, you know, Tito Ortiz or Rampage or somebody like that would complain. And then Dana White would come in there with a damn spreadsheet and, you know, like, no, he was paid this much over this many years. And then they'll want to do it. But it's like, why do it if you're not going to give us like even a name to go with some of that? I don't understand what the impetus for that is. I also, here's the thing, I'm going to say this again to my MMA media colleagues. When Dana White comes out here and says something like this, the word you want to use in your headlines is not Dana White revealed what Contender Series fighters are making.
Oh, I know what the word is.
Claimed. Dana White claimed. He has not offered you any proof. He's just reading numbers off a piece of paper. Didn't even show you the piece of paper. He's just reading numbers off the piece of paper, and you're going, all right, that must be what it is. Like, it might entirely be true. Kevin Holland like first said it wasn't him, then reversed course and was like, actually, maybe I do have $11 million. I just didn't do the math. I forgot to carry the one or something. But it could absolutely be true. But if he's just coming there to the press conference and saying numbers to you, you have not verified that. You don't know if that is true. That is a claim, my friends. If your mother says she loves you, check it out. That's the rule.
Journalism, baby. I'll look forward to more. We got a whole feast of Dana White's Contender Series. He's going to say more stuff. All a good time, of course. Mosatama. Big old fight against Hergovich this week. This is the litmus test for everyone over here. We're like, well, is this guy going to be the guy? We have a great article up on Uncrowned at the moment about, is he the next Mike Tyson? That is the things that people are saying about Mosatama. There it is there. Make sure you go over and check that out. I've asked you this a number of times, And I mean, I'm pretty sure the answer has always been an unequivocal no. Has the Mosatama buzz hit the United States?
Not in the part of the United States that I hang out in. I only hear about it. I hear about it from you. I hear about it when I get on to Uncrowned. But other than that, you don't hear about a whole lot of people talking about it. When you throw out stuff like the next Mike Tyson, it works in a couple different ways, because that will work on people. If you go to somebody...
Oh, we've seen it with McGregor. I mean, a million times in MMA, right? Is this guy the next Conor McGregor?
Yeah, if you go to somebody on the street and you're like, there's this guy fighting in a boxing match tonight, he's the next Mike Tyson. People will go, oh shit, really? Okay. I would like to see that. And it carries certain connotations, you know, where you're going, all right, I'm going to see a quick, violent knockout from a scary individual, and there's going to be sort of an aura there. But that's also a lot to live up to, because if they're showing up with that expectation, like when Mike Tyson first burst on the scene, everybody was just like, you're not going to believe this kid. Like, he's just a bulldog in there, and he's wrecking people left and right. But it wasn't like he didn't carry that thing where people were like saying he's the next something, you know? And so you have a lot to live up there. You have a certain very narrow kind of expectation that comes with being the next Mike Tyson. But as a selling point, it can work, I think.
Yeah, the opponent is like serious. Like, he's beat Zhou Li Zhang, he's beat Joe Joyce, David Adelaide, Dave Allen. You know, he has beat guys that are just before that level, that are just before that kind of prism of elite. You know, like they're just like can't quite get in there. It's like a force field, and Hergovic knocks them back. He has lost to Daniel Dubois, who we know knocked out Anthony Joshua. I'm very excited by Otama, but I do have this weird feeling, right? With all this kind of Fury and Joshua talk going on, and it's the Battle of Britain that's happening in America, but it's almost like they're... See the way you and Chuck have been saying to me, like, no, we haven't been force-fed this guy. And that's usually what boxing does. When they have a guy they want to get behind, it's like, look at this motherfucker. And we're in combat sports, so we see him. I'm like, are they kind of restraining the build of Otama because this Fury and Joshua situation is not settled? And they want to have this idea that if Mosatama fought either Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua right now, he would not absolutely bludgeon them, which he would, which I am very confident of. They don't exist in the same world as this kid. It's not going to happen. So I'm like, are they kind of holding back the global promotion of this man to allow these two to have the retirement fight, and then they're going to push him? Because really, holding up this guy is like, here's Mike Tyson, he's from England. Don't worry about Fury and Joshua. Yeah, I mean, they gave us a lot. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, it's almost like they're restraining the build on him because of this.
I think that there's a lot of that going around the heavyweight division in boxing right now, just in general. There's a sense, right? Yeah. Like, there's got to be a changing of the guard soon. This older generation, they have some big stars who are still, the names ring out, even if some of the physical ability has declined. And there's a feeling like a lot of people are waiting for that to subside. And then they're going, it's going to be our time to step into it. What they're not taking into account is how long people can stick around when the sport has become an ATM machine on their front lawn. And they keep saying, this is going to be the last one. This will be the last one. And we're almost done. But as long as that machine is still spitting out money, it's really hard for them to walk away. And so that can go on. It wouldn't be unreasonable to think it goes on 2 or 3 more years. And so you have a lot of people like right now, there's a sense that they're being patient and they're being like, okay, there's a whole crop of us waiting to step up and be those guys once these guys are gone. But they're really taking their time heading off to the rocking chair.
I've noticed that in the critic acclaimed crack notes, I've wrote, is Ben waking up for UFC Shanghai? And then I realized Ben doesn't need to wake up for UFC Shanghai. It's probably going to be on before he goes to bed, depending on his sleep schedule.
What are we looking at for a start time here?
I think, like, I'm on the blog, so I should really know this.
Yeah, you should.
I don't know.
This is concerning.
3 a.m. ET.
Oh.
Start time. So that's good. That's 1 a.m. your time.
Yeah, perfect. Well, I'm looking at it right now. The main card starts at 6 a.m. Eastern, so that's 4 a.m. here in the one true time zone. Yeah, I'm a...
No sleep. Roll up a fatty boom buddy. Get the TV on. Crack a beer. Let's go, baby.
You know how I prioritize my sleep schedule. As a gentleman of a certain age with two children, especially on a weekend, you know? And, Pete, I know I don't have to tell you this, but why I don't want to be sleep deprived that early on a Saturday morning night.
Okay. Okay. Oh, no. Oh, it's the Grizz, baby.
My beloved Montana Grizzlies open their football season with a night game against Southern Utah. And I can't be all
Southern Utah. The big, you're playing
the Thunderbirds of Southern Utah. When they open with a home game, they've been known to be careful in selecting an opponent for that home game. But we're looking at, I think, a 7 p.m. start time. If I'm up at 4 a.m. watching dudes from Shanghai, I'm going to be dragging ass by the time we get. And we can't have that. We need everybody in full support here. Also, I'll say this. I might have mentioned this before. It's tricky when we have a night game here in Missoula, Montana, which I will point out was recently named by USA Today to be the number one college sports town in America.
Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. It's incredible. The vibe on game day here is incredible. We got the stadium sitting right at the base of the mountain. It's beautiful. It's a great time. You get 25,000 people screaming in that stadium. I love it. It's a highlight of my Saturdays in the fall. But the Grizz fans are used to a 1 p.m. start time. That means that they are going to start their drinking 10 a.m., 11 a.m., get out there to the tailgates, all that kind of stuff, get tuned up in time. And so when you throw like one night game a year out there at them, they are not prepared for it. And a lot of people do not do a good job of pacing themselves.
Oh, I love
it. I went to a night game either last year or the year before, and you know, we go to the bar across the street from the stadium, and my wife came out of the bathroom and she was like, there is a 2 a.m. women's room vibe going on in that bathroom. Women are telling each other that they're beautiful. They're talking each other out of texting their exes. Like somebody's throwing up in one of the stalls. Like, and it was 5:30. So everybody got to pace themselves, but that means...
That sounds magic.
That means I'm going to catch up on these fights at a reasonable hour with a cup of coffee in the morning. I'm not waking up for this because I need to be fully locked in and ready to go for game time for the Grizz.
What's the plan? Like, you and Chad going? And is it hard to get tickets because it's 25,000? I'm sure everybody wants to go because it is the biggest college town in the United States of America. You know, everyone wants tickets.
You know, it's not that hard to get tickets. It depends on the game. For the Brawl of the Wild, when they play Montana State at the end of the season.
Oh, you don't have to tell me.
Big one. That's, you're going to spend a couple hundred bucks if you're just buying individual game tickets. Fortunately for me, my wife is a tenured professor at the University of Montana. They get a faculty discount. She's not a huge football or sports fan, so we end up sitting in the section right over by the marching band, and she loves to watch the marching band. I watch the football game, fill her in on what's going on over there. But the thing that Chad will always do is you'll talk to Chad Tuesday and Wednesday and be like, you want to go to the game this weekend? Should we find some tickets, go out there, hit up the tailgate? And he'd be like, I don't know. I might just stay home and watch this one on TV. But then
come on,
Thursday, Chad, or Friday, somebody will offer him a ticket, or I'll get a text Friday afternoon and it's just like a screenshot of the seat map and a couple tickets he's found. And he's like, what do you say? Should we get these? And I'm like, welcome in. Of course I want to go.
Beautiful. Well, best luck to the Grizz. I mean, I'm gonna try and watch as long as I can gamble on it. I'm gonna try and watch and I'll be very excited. Are you buying or selling this Umar and Omega Madoff Marab revenge situation that's going on, the alleged hatred that the Nurmagomedovs feel from Marab, who has said no, that's not the story there. Have you been seeing any of this? Like, are you bought into the idea of somehow these two meeting again, maybe when a championship's on the line, because of course Marab Pyotr Yan's happening again?
You know, I don't need a ton of that to get excited about those fights.
Yeah.
I don't need it. Cause those are interesting fights, you know, and I think Marab seems like he's got something going with everybody right now in the division. And also, like, you know, when Marab, I believe it was Marab, right, who was saying like, hey, I got mad at the Russian fighters for bringing their flag in there. One, because they wouldn't let me bring my flag in there. Two, because of Russia maybe not being the best neighbor in the region. lately. And you're like, legit, bad is legit, bro. But also, you know, look how many people Marab has run up on and slapped in the stands. You don't need to do a whole lot to get Marab willing to get mad at you and come over and fight you. He will fight you if you are a fan saying the wrong things to him. So it doesn't take that much. And those are all interesting matchups like that you could see play out in the future. Like right now, you know, the three of them, like Nurmagomedov, Marab, Pyotr Yan, that's just a triad there where you could just mix and match and make fights for like the next 2 years and they'd all be interesting.
Agree. Outside of the main event, it's not great. It's going to be a long morning for me, I think morning.
This reminds me though, like these kind of events, do you remember Lorenzo Fertitta back when the Fertittas still were big owners in the UFC? He would every once in a while come on and say something where you're like, oh, you kind of gave up the game a little bit. The businessman in you was just talking a little too frankly, and you kind of told us exactly what you guys are saying behind closed doors. And when they started doing some of these events in different places, and they were doing them like fight night quality events, not numbered events, and they were doing them at weird times to be prime time for those locations, and people were going, what the hell? How do you expect your fans to keep following this stuff if you're making them wake up at 3 a.m. to watch? And he said, the fights that we do in Shanghai are for Shanghai. The fights that we do over here are for there. And you kind of went, oh, wait a minute. You're running like a regional product here. You don't even expect us or care if we watch it. And that was a little bit illuminating. That's kind of how this one feels, right? Because the UFC is like, hey, we have a separate operation going on. We got Road to the UFC. We got like that kind of stuff going on over here.
That was on today. Road to UFC was on today. And like,
that's when I'm reminded that it exists. And that's when I go,
yeah.
I need to go back and change, because I've got it in my head. The tiers of UFC programming is numbered event, fight night event, and like on location outside of Las Vegas, and then fight night event in the Meta Apex. Road to UFC is down there somewhere, and you just forget about it.
Contender Series is way above.
It's above the Ultimate Fighter too. Like every once in a while, like somebody will just mention, like, "Hey, did you know the Ultimate Fighter has been on for the past 6 weeks or something?" I'm like, "No, I did not know that."
A fighter said to me last year or something, they're like, "Oh, I'm on the Ultimate Fighter," and I was like, "Okay," and they're like, "Isn't that cool?" And I was like, "No."
Or you'll hear sometimes now where like you'll see somebody on a UFC undercard and they'll be like, "He was an Ultimate Fighter winner," and I go, "Oh shit, no kidding."
Yeah,
that used to be a big deal. We used to have a show that was the Ultimate Fighter finale. Used to come out with that cut glass trophy. Sometimes you got a car or like a motorcycle that they didn't want you to ride or something like that. And now it's just sort of like a footnote on somebody's Wikipedia. You got to scroll down on the Wikipedia page to find the exhibition fights listed on their record to even know that they were on the Ultimate Fighter.
Oh my God. Well, look, I mean, we're all wearing football hats. We have our fancy football starting soon. Andy has said she's going to be involved. That's a contract, as far as I'm concerned. She has to show up. Oscar Losa, very quiet around the fancy football situation. I did not see an email from Oscar Losa. Jordan's in, I'm in, you're in, Chuck's in. Oscar, come on. You know what I mean?
You know.
And who else is in there? Like, Drake Riggs is in. Shaheen Al-Shadi's in, right? We're getting a formidable pack here, actually, when you think
about it. You know, not everybody was enthusiastic about my email inviting them to the Fantasy Football League. That's fine. I'm out here extending the hand of friendship.
I can't wait. When are we doing the draft?
See, that's I did not select a draft time yet because I was like, we need to be considerate of our people in far-flung time zones. Especially, I was like, if Pizzi and Oscar are going to get in, then I want to make sure that we don't select a draft time that's going to be like 4 a.m. for them. So we have some time to figure that out.
Okay. Perfect. Well, we're just about to go because I have to go asleep to get up to do the live blog. do we have any super chats, Andy?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that guitar riff. Pizzi and Ben, this is from KBOM1432. Thank you. PC and Ben, do you guys play fantasy football? If so, who is your fantasy MVP for 2026? P.S. The crack is the best. Keep up the great work, fellas. Thanks, KBOM1432. I played fantasy football on behalf of the team once. I was playing against all football podcasts, NFL podcasts, against actual athletes in the NFL, and I came 3rd out of 10. Wow. And I was like, you know, yeah. I got fucked with injuries. I'm not going to lie to you. I should have won the whole fucking thing. I'm still a bit upset about it. Who's my MVP? Honestly, quarterback. Give me like Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen, the guys who run them in as well as throw them. You know what I mean? I want a dual threat quarterback who scores a lot of shit. That is what my number one pick would be, especially if I'm later in the draft and all the big guns go. Like if someone's got Derek, you see, I'm like, I don't know who's hot shit this draft. I haven't really got myself in, but I'd be like a Derrick Henry kind of guy. You know what I mean? Just a guy who just keeps fucking going. Keeps on going. That's what.
Yeah, I mean, I historically have been terrible at fantasy football. I've never won a league or even really come close.
Excited about that.
Because especially when it comes to the draft, I don't really know how to do it. I put it together as if I'm putting together like a video game football team where I'm like, well, first off, I want a star quarterback or something, and that's not really how you're supposed to do it, I guess. For me though, I was looking at like, okay, what do people say you're supposed to do? And then what do I know about the players that I actually feel like when I'm watching games, you're hearing that guy's name all the time and it feels like no one can stop him. And so I'm like, give me a Jackson Smith and Jigba. Give me a Puka Nacua. You know, give me guys like that. I had Christian McCaffrey.
Nacua, run them in, catch them. I mean, McCaffrey's knee. I mean,
that's the thing is I had Christian McCaffrey because I was like, man, I remember watching last year when he was destroying everybody. Let me get him this year. And then he was just plagued with injuries, and I felt responsible. I felt like maybe I did that to him a little bit. So we'll see. But I'm excited. I'm excited to retool my strategy and my thinking this year.
Are you getting liquored up for this draft? You look at liquored
up? You don't have to try too hard to talk me into it. If it's something that we're doing, if we're all like on Zoom or something,
we're gonna get a load of light beers and just keep plowing them as we're going through the round.
Ugh.
I don't know. Actually, I'll see how the situation is here. But anyway, is that all the super chats we have, Andy? Oh. Rest in peace, Harald the Fifth, the King of Norway. Rest in peace to him. Is that
did he die recently, or is that from 300 years ago? Oh no, here we go. It's a story. CNN headline: Harald the Fifth, the sailing king who epitomized a modern Norwegian royalty, dies.
Oh well,
dead at 89. R.I.P.
At least he got to see the team go so far in the World Cup. He got to see Erling Haaland. You know, beautiful. Beautiful things.
It's crazy. I kind of respect how, especially like the Scandinavian countries, when you're over there, they're like, yeah, we got some royalty still, but we don't make a big deal of it.
They do not make a big
deal. I appreciate that. When I was in Copenhagen, went to like one of the museums, and you're just like, they go, hey, you can walk in here. Do you want to see the king's throne? It's right in here. This is his house. You're in his house right now. Come on. Come see his throne. And I was just like, shit, there it is. Okay.
I told you that like when we were at the ballet there in Tivoli Gardens, the king and queen just came in and sat there. We all had to stand up for a second, but there was no security, nothing. Just like, okay, weren't even dressed up. They're just like, all right, looking forward to whatever it is we saw. Forget the name of it.
Respect.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all we've got for you guys, I think. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. Brett, 1909K. Dylan is a huge Uncrowned fan. Went on the Helwani show and went on the crack in the same week. Oh.
I see what he did.
Yeah. Fair play. Mm-hmm. Fair play, Brad.
That's not bad.
We're not laughing. Aussie Strike. Petey, can you please ask? It's kind of gone Tony Ferguson with the font here. Can you please ask our resident co-maniac to share with us his favorite horror movie? Thanks heaps. Okay. There you go.
See, this is...
Is this a behind a paywall inside
joke? Yeah, well, the co-main event we have for our Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/co-main-event, we have a movie club, and we put it up for a vote, we'll watch a movie, we'll discuss it, and we normally don't do horror movies. I'm not a huge horror movie guy. Chad...
I wouldn't be either.
Chad is terrified and hates horror movies, but then we ended up watching Green Room, a horror film that I'd never heard of before, about like a punk rock band who finds himself in a horror situation. And I hated it. I hated that the movie was made. I hated that they did it to me, that they forced me to sit through it. I have a lot of thoughts that I intend to share. The question I have with horror movies is the things that happen inside my brain when I watch a horror movie, are the same things happening in the brains of people who love horror movies? Because I know people who, that's their favorite genre of movies, horror. Is the same chemicals being released in their brain, or are there different chemicals? Or is it that it is the same chemicals and they just like it, and I don't like it?
Yeah.
But I do like some. I will say probably my favorite one The one where I was like, that's an amazing movie and also scared the hell out of me, but in a way I had to respect, was Hereditary. That was one where I went to bed at night as like a 40-year-old man, grown man at the time, and I went to bed at night and I was saying to myself, it's just a movie. It's just a movie. I was scared. That movie was scary.
I bet Andy, our producer, loves scary.
Yeah, movies. She gives off that vibe. There it is.
What's your favorite, Andy? Oh, it's on there. She's The Conjuring. She's talking here. She's giving The Conjuring as one of them.
Oh, okay.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
And then Obsession. I have not seen
I heard about
yet.
That. A lot of Nightmare on Elm Street. I used to love those when I was a kid, and my parents would be like, no, you can't watch them. You get nightmares and you wake us up in the middle of the night. And I'd be like, no, I won't. This time I won't. That's promise. And then I remember them letting me watch one of them. And then I was laying in bed that night being like, you got to just tough it out, man. You can't get up and tell them you got nightmares. They said this is going to happen. You got to prove them wrong. You got to just like sit here and like, but I used to love those. I read like novelizations of Nightmare on Elm Street when I didn't know what a novelization was. I was like, well, yeah, these are great movies. It makes sense that it was a novel first and that they adapted the novel for the screen. But the thing that I got mad at when I went to see The Odyssey, one of the previews before The Odyssey was for The Other Mommy. Have you seen the preview for The Other Mommy? It's an assault on the senses. And when they showed this preview, I was like, I'm gonna write a strongly worded letter. You can't, my friend, he got really mad. My friend, the New York Times writer, Dan Brooks, shout out to @DangerBrooks on Twitter. He made the analogy where he was like, you showing me that preview before I go watch a movie of a completely different genre, and this preview is freaking me out. It's like if I went to like a Mexican restaurant and a dude pops up from under the table and throws sushi in my mouth. Like I didn't sign up for that experience. Don't do that to me.
Oh my God. Elaine loves scary movies too, but I don't. I'm with you. Okay, I'm with you on this. I love The Shining, the film The Shining, because it's so freaky. You know, it's freaky. It's not like, one of them jumpy ones. Apart from when they run up the stairs and you see all the fucking weird shit. And I'm watching that, and it'll still freak me out, you know what I mean? And as I'm watching it, I'm like engrossing it. Elaine will start laughing at my fear. She'll be like, look at you. Did you think that was scary? Oh my God. And I'm like, this takes me out of it, you know what I mean? When this kind of shit happens. So basically, I've taken horror movies off the menu now. It's because I'm not going to get laughed at, you know what I mean? I'm not going to get laughed at.
You're very serious, man.
But yeah. The Shining would be mine. Oh shit, we've got loads today. Woke Dog O, I believe. What are your thoughts on Usman? I've seen polls online that have him as a favorite against Topuria. I think we're about to witness a big fraud check coming up. In my opinion, he loses to Salkill in under two rounds. Salkill's a beast though. He could be up in that fucking, he probably is already based on what he did to Gamrot. Yeah, you could be right, because we talked about this last week. You never know until you know. Mm-hmm. I think he's, I fully believe that he is an elite 155. I don't see a fraud check. He's just so well-rounded, but I won't be like 100% guaranteed because patchy mix. That is all I need to say about that.
Well, yeah, you do need to see them in the UFC context before you know how they match up. But also, the thing that makes me think that you're not dealing with a fraud is that camp don't produce too many frauds. If you were a fraud in that camp, you are killed as a small child. If you make it out of there, if you survive training with those guys, then you must be pretty good and pretty tough. Otherwise, they essentially would have hurled you off a cliff from a great height. So you got to be pretty good.
Gonna set up better myself. We have anything else, Andy? Oh shit, we are getting hit with the super test. Is the 11 mil about Pratchett's or Nickel? It's Kevin Holland.
Well, and see, that's the thing, is that the way you know it's not Prochaska or Nickel is that they haven't had a chance to have a ton of fights because they're not making that much per fight. And Kevin Holland's whole thing has been that the way he got in, remember like Dana White's story about him, which Dana White told it as if it was like a great story. And I was like, I don't think this reflects well on you guys and how you do business, was that basically Kevin Holland showed up in the Contender Series, was talking a lot during his fight. And Dana was like, I don't like him. I don't like this guy. He's a big mouth. He talks way too much. And then when they had somebody else fall out of a fight, he was like, call that big mouth guy, see if he'll take it. And he did. And that's been Kevin Holland's MO, like while he's in the UFC, is he's the guy who will take whatever fight you got. He will show up and he won't win them all, because you can't win them all if you're doing that. But he will show up. He will fight a ton. He will get bonuses. He has like a bonus friendly fighting style, but that's the way he's doing it. He's doing a volume business, and that's the only way you can have like come off one of those contender series contracts. Because a big part of making a lot of money coming off the contender series is one of the first things you got to do is fight enough to get off that contract and get onto a better contract.
And I think a lot of the money was like the short notice fights, as you said. You know,
that's how you get a big bump in pay, is the willingness to pick up the phone of a Tuesday afternoon and be like, yeah, I can be there and fight Saturday night.
Not many motherfuckers going to weigh in to fight Tony Ferguson and then actually fight Hamzat Chimaev. That's the kind of deal. You know what I mean? That is where the money is coming from here. Do we have anything else, Andy? Well, what the life lessons, combat sports, I guess. Do you see a realistic way for pay for mixed martial artists in the UFC to get better? Antitrust cases, political reform, unions, something else. Actually, I'm going to say no at the moment. Actually, ever since the first antitrust lawsuit kind of went the way it did, when we had... Look, I mean, I know a lot of people are very happy with the checks they got. Don't get me wrong. But the whole idea of that first kind of... That first one was, we're not going to be bought out of this. And granted, they might have got a good deal and some people are happy with it. I always just felt like the bigger changes came if they kept pushing. Now, there is still the other side of this class action lawsuit, the 2017 onwards part, the Cajun Johnson side, which could get that, I believe. We'll have to get John Nash on to ask him again. But honestly, right now, I feel like it's more of a monopoly than ever. And it's like spread into the regional scenes. And it's like, I don't see a quick fix to this. Do you, Ben?
Quick fix, no. I would say the key to how do you get a significantly better pay, not just, hey, the UFC is making more money from Paramount, so they're going to turn around and say, oh, we're going to give them a little more. But in order to see like something like a fair, you know, 50-50 distribution of revenue like you see in other sports, the key to that is collective bargaining. You have to get some kind of collective bargaining situation going. And there's a couple different ways to do that. But, you know, the antitrust case, I think you still got another one going. So that's probably your best hope for doing it. Legislatively, I don't think there's any hope, especially right now, the way the American government is right now. The UFC has a lot of friends over there. And it is just generally a very business-friendly and not so much worker-friendly government right now. That could change, but not anytime soon, probably. The antitrust cases are your best hope, and that's the way it's happened in other sports. Like, if you look at the timeline of how, you know, antitrust lawsuits essentially is what got the NFL collective bargaining, but it wasn't a quick process. It was like 10 years between filing those cases and having a NFL Players Association that has to negotiate with the NFL in order for them to get an antitrust exemption. So it's kind of a situation of the people who plant the trees will never be around long enough to sit under the shade of them. And that's just the way it works. But like, if they're ever going to get there, some kind of collective bargaining is the only route.
Hey, amen. Anything? Oh my God. Jerake O the Ball Star.
Okay, I love this question.
Ben, where's your go-to spot for watching the Grizz?
Okay, Jerake.
I'm interested to know. Now, I want you to paint it. Like, what does it look like? What are the chairs like, et cetera?
So, it depends what kind of a time you're trying to have. That's the thing. What kind of a party do you want to be having when you watch the Grizz game? Because for one thing, I love going to the games. Like, when they're at home, there's no experience. Like, they've got a great stadium. It's just so beautiful. It feels so good to be out there.
They limit your beers?
Well, you're talking college football, so you got a beer garden that's like technically right outside the stadium. You can't buy beer when you're actually in there. So you gotta go in there with a plan. You gotta show up to the tailgate in time. No one's saying, Pete, that a fella couldn't take a little plastic bottle of Fireball, stick it in his sock, walk in there with it. That's been known to happen.
Okay.
You know, I've heard rumors that something like that can happen, but you got to go, you hit up the tailgate. If I'm going to the game, my strategy is going to be, all right, I'm going to leave the house. I'm going to go to the press box which is the bar right across the footbridge, right across the river from the stadium. It's going to have a real game day atmosphere. The press box knows what they're doing because they're like, hey, look, it gets super crowded in here on game days. So not only are we going to have the bar inside, we're going to set up a little temporary bar under a little tent out in the parking lot. Ooh. Make sure that you can get a beer real quick, no waiting. You can stand out there in the parking lot if the weather's nice, drink yourself a beer. And then you're going to walk over to Lando's tailgate. You'll know it because it has the great big Montana Till I Die flag flying above it. And you can hear the 90s rap from blocks away.
Oh,
you're
going
to go
yes.
over to Lando's tailgate. He's going to put a cold Miller Lite in your hand as soon as he sees you. He's going to dap you up and you're going to have a great time. And then you're going to go into the game and then you're going to come back out at halftime. Have yourself another Miller Lite before you go back in there. That's if you're trying to have the full
I did not know that was an option.
Game day experience. Now, if the Grizz are away or if I'm just feeling like I can't deal with the crowds, I don't want to go. I don't have tickets to the game. I'm not going to go do the game day scene down there at the stadium. Then I go to my local, the Town and Country Lounge, the TNC, if you nasty, right up here, right up the street. Going to be pretty muted atmosphere. The bartenders know me. They start pouring the drink when they see me walk in the door. If I want to watch something on TV, they're obviously going to have the Grizz game, but if I want to watch something different, they'll just give me the remote and let me go crazy. That's how I get to watch like soccer games over there when I want to. They'll just give you the remote and let you do it. And
that's a dream. That is a dream. Yeah.
That's where you'll find when the Grizz are away. If I don't have my kids and I'm not like having to watch it at home while I'm like making people sandwiches and shit, you can find me up at the TNC.
I was Googling the places as you were mentioning.
The TNC is a trailer.
Fantastic.
It is a double wide trailer in the parking lot of a grocery store, and it is the most perfect place
on
earth.
I didn't Google that one.
Yeah.
It sounds fantastic. Do you have time for me to just tell you why I will never be given the remote control in my local pub?
Is it because of the time where they tricked you?
Yes. Okay, I've already told you. It's fine.
It's a great story, though. Basically, other people haven't heard it.
Basically, it was like it was a fight. I can't remember. I think it might have been a Katie Taylor fight. And they didn't have the channel. It was like a pay-per-view and the barman's going, I'm not. Like, the place is fucking heaving. And everyone's like, pay for the fucking fight. And he's like, I'm not paying for the fight. It's going to be over in 2 minutes anyway. Get your drinks and fuck off. My friend, Graham Merrigan, texts me and says, tell him to put on channel 862 or whatever it was. And I was like, put on 862. The man puts on 862 and it was the free view of the porn channels all over.
That guy's a legend for pulling that one off on you, man. That is incredible. He must have just been like sitting back and just being like, it's not going to get any better than this.
He said, getting the message like 5 minutes later after I took all the abuse from everybody, me just going, fuck you, man. He was like, that was the most beautiful moment to hear that you were in your pub when you fucking said
that. That's where, preparation meets opportunity. Something beautiful can happen.
We don't have any super chats left, right? Do we, Andy? Oh, whoa. I mean, we got a volcano, like a flurry. I don't know what to call it. An avalanche of super chats there. We love you, crackheads. We'll be back next week. Chuck Mellenhall should be back as well. He's enjoying a bit of galvanizing this week. Ben, you enjoy the Grizz game. Andy, you enjoy whatever horror film you're going to watch tonight. Oscar Losev, you keep enjoying that beautiful face of yours. And we will see you next week. Mwah!